Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, June the 27th, 2024, and we are up to episode 3,515 of the Survival Podcast, and we've done it with you guys, the audience, the community, around the Survival Podcast. Be able to say something like 3,515 for an episode number of a podcast. There's not a lot of podcasts out there can say that. So as I often say, but I probably should say more often, thank you to all of you who have supported me since 2008 in doing the Survival Podcast. I bet we have people listening today who probably were born when the show started, but they were probably in diapers or something like that. So youngins, welcome as well. Today is an expert council Q&A show for the week, and I've got a great lineup of experts, including some we haven't heard from recently. One group we hear from every week are Ron Paul and his team with the Ron Paul Liberty Highlights. Today I got Dr. Paul and I got Chris Rossini talking about the war on cash and the push for CBDCs, at least in the U.S., being doomed before it even starts. We'll listen to that one together. I haven't heard it yet. I have some concerns beyond it actually being doomed, though. We'll see what they have to say on it. Sean Mills will talk about thoughts on plug-in versus whole-house surge protectors. I'm really glad we're doing this because both have a place for different reasons, and Sean, I'm sure, will break that down for us. Andy McCann will ask about youth competitive sports and does it make sense. He's going to take one angle on it. I'll throw a little bit of a different angle on it, but I think we kind of have the same opinion. Doc Bones will talk about something called DMSO. What is it? Don't worry, Doc will tell you. He'll talk about potential uses, potential dangers, or potential contraindications with DMSO. Contraindications being, it's a safe thing to use, but not if combined with this other thing. And are there any of those for DMSO? And again, what is it? Doc will tell you. Nicole Sauce will talk about phosphates and their potential dangers or uses with DIY cleaning products. You roll your own cleaning product. What about phosphates? Jeb Lawton will talk about dealing with excessive cattails that are blocking a drain. Maybe you should talk to our United States government. You know that dam that's overflowing? Yep, one of y'all sent me a picture of that dam. Two of the floodgates are closed, and there's a whole shitload of debris. And if you open the floodgates and you got rid of the debris, the failure of the dam would probably stop. But this is much easier to fix than that. We just got a drain in a system where the cattails are completely overtaking it and clogging it up. So what was the solution, because cattails are great filtration vegetation, has become the problem. So we got to reverse that and make the problem the solution the way that we're supposed to with permaculture. Speaking of permaculture, someone we have not heard from recently, Ben Falk, up in the wilds of Vermont, has some thoughts for you on design principles and tips and tricks for your wood shop / workshop in your home. He even has an online course on this that might be worth taking. I have a link to that in the show notes. And I have a question on aquaculture, what I haven't really talked much about lately. I probably need a show on it again. But person asked a question. How do I pellet train fish that are like from the wild? Like I have catfish or bluegills or something like that. I brought them home, put them in a tank. I threw them pellets and they went, they ain't eating that. How do you get it done? Well, there's a short answer I'll give you right now. You let them get hungry enough, they'll freaking eat it. There's some other things to consider, though. So I've already given this individual the short answer by email. I do that often. And sometimes the short answer is all you get, but often when you ask a question for the show, you'll also get a longer, more illuminating answer on air. And then, I have an idea. I have an idea. This is really not a segment, just something I'll throw in at the end. A name for my Jersey Giant rooster came to me this morning. I asked you guys, I got a bunch of suggestions on names. A big, giant, black rooster that we thought was a girl. One of you guys said Big Mike. I got the joke. But I have a different idea, and I'm going to bounce it off you at the end, and we're running a poll on X that you can vote in. If you want to go vote in it right now, you can, and you'll find out the answer before I get there. Just go to my account on X / Twitter, whatever the hell it is called today, and you can do that. Otherwise, I'd love to hear back from you guys on my thoughts for a name for my rooster. And I'll tease it a little bit here before we dig in, okay? So one of my roosters in the past went through this same evolution. We bought a bunch of straight run birds, but then we also bought some red sex links that were all, since they were sex links and they're easy to tell, they were all supposed to be pullets, just like this time. And I ended up getting rid of a whole bunch of roosters. They were Egyptian, Fayomis. And they were just assholes and I never got any size to them, so I got rid of them. And I kept him. And he ended up being just this great, chill-ass, pimping rooster, so we named him Upgrade, with two Ds, for a double dose of pimping. And I liked that bird. He was my buddy, and I used to hang out with me. And this new rooster, he's kind of my buddy, too, that likes to hang out. And I thought of using another name from the movie Idiocracy that will fit him in a way. Some of you have figured it out. Some of you are going to fast forward. Some of you are going to jump on X. And some of you will wait, like good little boys and girls, to see what the name is. With that, let's go ahead and dive on into it. Hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini about the war on cash and the push for things like CBDCs.
Major venues now punishing people for using cash versus plastic. So I have a legal tender bill here, and I don't know who's breaking the rules. I know that I know that the federal government and the Federal Reserve are breaking a lot of rules and a lot of not only etiquette but just honesty and money. But here's a bill, famous. It's United States of America. We have them all the way up still to $100. It used to go up to $500 and maybe even bigger. But even these bills, it says, this bill is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Now, is that a mandate, or are we able to use it and satisfy debt? Well, I don't think anybody wants to think about that. That just confuses people about legal tender, because we'd like to just eliminate the whole system and let the government get out of it, out of rigging the system.
That's right, Dr. Paul. Yeah, I had a family member recently tell me, you know, they went to a baseball game, and everything has to be credit. They won't take any cash. You're basically penalized. Then you have to go to an ATM and pay a fee to go get your money to go use the stadium. So, yes, they're trying to eliminate cash. It is a big threat to privacy. And, you know, most transactions these days are credit anyway, but they want total surveillance of all our transactions. They want no escape, you know, into cash, to where they can't see where everything is going on. And this is very similar to the vaccine passports. They wanted total control of our movements. I've been jabbed this many times. Look, I'm up to date. Look at my app. You know, thankfully that flopped and went up in flames, that Nazi-like tyranny. But, you know, these people that want this stuff, they don't give up. This war on cash is just another angle. And, you know, it's very disappointing. You know, our major sports leagues, they're like arms of the government. Everything the government does, the sports leagues, they have their pom-poms cheerleading everything, and they're always at the forefront testing this tyranny on us. You know, it's a shame. And the tech companies are the same way. They had the apps for this contact tracing, and you're going to show how up-to-date you are so you could get into places while all the diseased people stayed out in the parking lot. You know, the major problem with this is, if all money is digital and controlled by the state, it means they can take money out of your account without you having any say about it. They want a war with Iran? You wake up one day and $1,000 is gone. That's your contribution to the war. And this happened in Cyprus, I believe, during a financial crisis. People, they call it a haircut. They went in their bank account. Was less than it was the day before. They just confiscate the money, and there's no way out. You can't go take out cash. Your money is completely at their mercy. Now, this won't work, this stuff, and I'll get into that later. But this is the goals. This is the delusions that they dream up. These vaccine passports, getting rid of cash, but there will always be workarounds, and we'll get to that soon.
you know, the argument is that the government has to do this and the Fed's involved to keep the people honest, you know, that they're not cheating and they're not stealing and this sort of thing. And I got to thinking, well, what we have here is that we have a need for keeping the government honest, and that we don't have.
Well, yes. Authoritarians have these fantasies that they one day can just turn the key, and then all of human life is boxed in for them to manipulate. But that's not going to happen, because you cannot box in the human mind, human creativity. So government makes rules. We have more rules than they even know exist anymore. And yet for every single one of those rules, there's people that get around them, always. Because all they have to do is, okay, here's the situation, how do we get around this? And then they sit and think, and they figure out a way, period. And so if they want to lock people into a digital money prison, immediately, or even beforehand, alternative currencies will be created, both physical, digital, and black markets will form immediately. And here's the irony of it. Politicians themselves will participate in the alternative currencies and black markets because they're some of the most corrupt people on earth. So they're going to want stuff that's off the books and not, used with the official digital currency. People will have two accounts, the one the government sees and the one the government doesn't see. So that's why this whole idea is a fool's errand. But again, they have this fantasy that they're going to lock people in. But this works both ways. We would like for the politicians to follow the rules too. We would love for them to follow the Constitution. They break every single one because they look at the law, the Constitution, they say, how do we get around this? We can't counterfeit money, so we won't. The Federal Reserve will do it. We can't censor. We won't. The Facebooks will do it for us. So it's the same thing. They use their creative mind to get around the rules. In this case, it's the Constitution, it's a law they're supposed to follow, and they do the same exact thing that citizens do to them. So it's a constant cat and mouse game, this life that we are in here. We just need freedom to dominate. At all times, one or the other is going to dominate, either tyranny or freedom. Early in our country's history, freedom dominated, and there was great results of it. Today, tyranny dominates, and look at the results. They're terrible. So this idea that they're going to lock the doors and everybody is going to be in their digital prison is a fantasy.
Now, let me say, I agree that people will work around it. There's a meme that's been redone over and over again with different images, but it's basically a libertarian and an ANCAP talking to each other and saying, these new regulations will fundamentally alter the way that we get around them. So I agree with that. In the beginning, it sounded like Ron was hinting toward, you can't do it because it's unconstitutional or it's illegal because the money itself as legal tender has to be accepted because it says so right on it. That doesn't matter. And there is a fundamental misunderstanding about what legal tender says. As far as the legal tender law, you don't have to take dollars, let alone cash. You don't have to take anything as a seller. Now, if you get sued in court and the court orders a settlement and you say, but I don't want dollars, they'll say, tough shit, that's what you're getting. That's part of legal tender. If you advertise your price in dollars, you have to take dollars. Legal tender covers that. If you say, we take no bills larger than a 20, that's completely legal, and that's your personal preference, and this is where this all goes to a problem. They don't have to pass any laws. They just have to push onto society to where almost everybody that does business in the modern world refuses to take cash. And there's nothing legal that can be done about that. If your grocery store or whatever says, we don't take cash, they don't have to. And the legal tender law or the United States Constitution does not impact that in any way, shape, or form. But getting around it, that's the reality. I mean, it amazes me. I think Ron's just a bit too old to grok Bitcoin. He's a bit too deep in the boomer generation because they never really talk about Bitcoin or crypto even. But, yeah, those days are over. It's already done. We can already transfer value without them. What they still have right now, though, and we are in a state where we're not quite where we need to be to get past this yet, where it won't matter, is on-ramps and off-ramps. The thing that makes Bitcoin and other crypto have value right now, some it's illusionary, some is legit, but it's because it can be changed into dollars. When people look at their Bitcoin stack, they look at it in USD value. They don't look at it in how many Satoshis they have. I think we're starting to make a turn there, and the evolution of technologies like Lightning, like Cashew, like something called the Arc, which has nothing to do with Cathie Wood, that's going to change that soon. It really is. We're on the cusp of kind of phase two. I think I talk about Bitcoin a lot, but a lot of you guys are like, I wish I would have got in when Jack did. No, you didn't. No, you don't, because you wouldn't have, because you could have, and you didn't. Also, you probably would have spent most of it, and I know that, because I did. And I've tried over the last 4 or 5 years to kind of be a repentant semi-shit coiner and Bitcoin spender and teach more of the richest man in Babylon philosophy, substituting Bitcoin for gold. Stack it. It's your slave. Never let go of it. You take your slave and its children, its children's children, and put it to work for you forever in the form of Bitcoin. But there'll be a place for spending it too, especially if you're earning it. See, when I say never spend it, what I'm talking about is you had surplus capital, you swept it into Bitcoin, you obviously didn't need it, so don't spend it. That's different than if you were being paid in Bitcoin. Well, you got to pay your bills, and that's fine. So I think we will get around whatever they do, but I think we're much closer to a cashless society than people realize. And it's being done in the name of safety, not even obedience, compliance, and you know, drugs and all that other shit. That's all herbs they throw on top, fresh herbs on top of the dish at the end. You know what they do? How they actually get it done? They convince people, if you accept cash, you're a target to be robbed. Right? That's why you go, for instance, my grandson plays baseball. They have a pretty decent snack bar for a kid's baseball field. But if you go to get something, they don't take cash. And when I ask them why, they're like, we're afraid we're going to get robbed. What, for a few $100? You see what I mean? Like, if you can scare a snack bar at a Little League game into not taking cash because they'll get robbed. Need coupons, right? Coupons at the state fair because you might get robbed. Think of a grocery store and the amount of cash that they would end up with if they routinely say that's what they're doing, and they will convince the industries of the world to not take cash in the name of their own safety. And there's not much you can do about that other than not shop in those places. But what happens when this is not an easy one-and-done thing, and it's something we keep an eye on. Anyway, we'll quit beating up on that, and we'll go to something a little more productive. Sean Mills on whole houses versus plug-in surge protection.
Hey, guys, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got a question from John. John says, do you recommend point-of-use surge protectors or whole house surge protectors? I have a few plug-in surge protectors throughout my house, but was reading that some manufacturers recommend replacing them every 3 to 5 years. I'm considering installing a whole house surge protector and wondering if you have any experience or recommendations. Thanks, John. Hey, John. Good question. So there's a couple things to consider here. The first one is the whole house surge protector. That's going to protect from massive, very high voltage surges coming in from the grid. Okay. Now, those could be things like a surge from a transformer after the power goes off. It could be a lightning strike. It could be an EMP, for example. All right. And that's going to protect against, like, say, everything over 600 volts, right? That's a standard voltage for these whole house surge protectors is 600. But what that doesn't do is it doesn't protect from any internal surges in the system, or surges that might come in at below 600 volts. Well, your 120-volt appliances in your house will absolutely fry if you try to jut, say, 200 volts in them, okay? So one of the things about electronics is that they can handle the potential, which is what voltage measures, right, up to whatever they're rated for. But if you go much beyond that, then the internal components burn up, whereas from a current standpoint, the current is pulled rather than pushed. And so your overcurrent devices are really there to protect the wire when a device tries to pull too much current through the system, for whatever the breaker, for example, is rated for. So those are the two things to remember is you've got current, which does one thing. It gets pulled through the system to the device, and you got voltage, which kind of gets pushed. So if you literally take a 120-volt appliance and cut the plug off and wire it into the two hots instead of the hot and the neutral and plug that into a 240-volt system, you'll just immediately fry the internal components. And so if you have 240 volts running through the 120 volt circuit for some reason, then it can fry those 120 volt components and never trip that whole house surge protector. So the reality is you probably need both. Now, there's a bunch of us within the community that work with EMP Shield. They do have a 120 to 240 volt system that you can buy on their website. Go to empshield.com. My personal affiliate code with them is HMHS for like Hack My Homestead. And if you put that code in, you can get $50 off one of their whole house surge protectors that you wire right into your main panel. So that would, again, take care of anything coming in from the street side. But I would still definitely utilize any components that you have in the house that are 120 volts that are going to be sensitive to voltage spikes, I would use the plug-in surge protectors as well. Or they actually make surge protectors that will replace your outlets. So if you don't like having a bunch of those, corded surge protectors in the house with a bunch of things plugged into them, and you only need to protect a couple components, you could actually go and replace your wall outlet with a surge protector wall outlet. And then everything that's plugged into that specific outlet gets that protection. At my house, I like the plug-in ones because I can go and just turn off everything that's hooked into that with the flip of a switch. So, for example, in my bedroom, we've got a TV and a Roku. No, it's not a Roku. It's a Fire Stick, Amazon Fire Stick. And we watch movies occasionally, my wife and I, in the bedroom. But when we're not watching those movies, we have that thing flipped off because we don't need the TV and the Fire TV stick drawing power for 2 weeks in between us watching a movie in the bedroom, right? So I like the ability to go and flip those things off when there's a problem. But if you don't like the look of them or if they get in the way, then you can also, like I said, look into getting one of those in-wall outlet surge protectors. They work great. And they also make some that just plug in like right on top of the outlet, and there's like six different plugs. And so that's another option to help with like cord management and stuff like that. But yeah, just going back to the question again, which one would I do if it was me? Well, both. Both is the answer. And you don't have to do the EMP Shield. There's other ones that you can get off of Amazon, but I like the idea of EMP Shield having that $25,000 insurance policy so that if their system fails, anything behind that unit that gets fried in the house, they're going to pay for it to be replaced. All right, guys, well, that's all I have for that question. Keep getting those questions into Jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
All right, real quick at the end of that, if you buy one of these, please use Sean's code so you can make a little bit of money. My personal opinion of EMP Shield, and I don't want to sound hostile or anything, it is an excellent whole house surge protector. That's what it is. That's what it does. I have been asked to sell for them many times. I know I could make a lot of money doing it. The reason I don't do it is I don't do fear-based marketing. Your house is not going to get destroyed by an EMP. Your house is not going to get destroyed by an EMP. Your house is not going to get destroyed by an EMP. And when you talk to those guys and you call them on their shit, they admit it. They admit it. They admit what they're selling. They're selling is probably the best whole house surge protector on the market. And the only reason I'm not an affiliate with them is because I will not do anything that's in your face for your base marketing. Because you're not going to protect yourself from an EMP or GoldenEye or the space aliens beyond the moon or whatever other bullshit is in your head because you listen to Alex Jones or whatever else. Okay? Sorry, I had to say it. It's a great product. The marketing is ass. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about competitive sports for kids with Andy McCann.
Hey guys, this is Andy McCann with CrossFit Garage here in Woodstock, Georgia, coming to you with a question from Jamie from Arizona. She asked, Jack, this is for Andy. So not exactly a health and fitness question, but I listened to a few of your episodes and wanted a short take on your thoughts on youth competitive sports and if it's worth it. Okay, so I'm not sure which ones you listen to because I have got a few episodes where I totally trash it and then also bring it back up. I think, as Jack has said, and anybody will tell you, that really the answer to any question starts with, it depends. So what are your goals? I'm going to go with the idea, though, that you're thinking, hey, youth competitive sports, I'm going to keep pushing my kid and they're going to get a pro contract. So here's the simple trick to know if your kid is any good. If you hear parents and other people randomly say, wow, that kid number three is awesome, who is that? Then your kid is a standout. If you have to fish for the compliment, hey, who do you think is the best on that team? Isn't it maybe my kid? Or if you're the parent telling the coach, why isn't my kid playing more because he's the best on the team? Your kid's not the best on the team. When a kid is singled out by everybody, and you'll know it when you see it, and if you've never seen it, then you've never seen a kid that has the genetics and the motivation to do the sport. That kid can go far. Your kid? Probably not. So is it worth it in terms of can they go pro? Man, there are the chances of making money going pro are so slim. Like, I guess what problem are you solving? I want my kid to be pro because he's famous. I want my kid to be a pro because there's a lot of money. I want my kid to be pro because that's a dream that I had. I mean, what are you solving? There, if you're thinking to yourself, well, I just want to get a scholarship to go to college. Here's the thing. If you're in Georgia, there's something called the Zell Miller Scholarship and the Hope Scholarship. Basically, if you have good grades, you get to go to college pretty dang cheap. So I would say save your money. So I have four kids. They all played club soccer. I paid about $2,000 a year for each of them to play soccer. I have, you know, like I said, four kids. That's $8,000. I paid probably for 10 years in club soccer. That's $80,000. What could we have done with that money? So, what is the goal you're trying to solve? Is it worth it? Pros? No, probably not. College? Probably not. Just go get the other scholarship, right? Get a smart scholarship. Well, my kid's not smart. Okay, great. Go for that. I would probably aim for a sport that not many people do, and maybe one that has more longevity. Seriously, when's the last time any of us broke out into a soccer game? But a whole hell of a lot of us are playing pickleball. So maybe aim down that route. Now, all that to say, it is worth it if you're looking to build character. So I love the fact that competitive sports creates a false environment, a fake environment where it matters. It doesn't matter. Who cares, right? But it does matter. So as an example, one of my kids got cut multiple times in tryouts and year to year to year or season to season, whatever. And he said, you know what? I'm going to make it. And he made it his goal and he worked his butt off and he made the team. Another one of my kids got cut and within 4 years, he was MVP on the team. So what lesson did they learn? Man, my kids learned a pretty dang good lesson. If you want it and hard work will get it, let's do it. But you have to buckle down and do it. Now, the other lesson they learned is I was the star for a moment, and then little Timmy decided he wanted to be the star, and he outpassed my effort. Here's the problem with competitive youth sports. They sell you on the dream, and they will take your money. There is always a harder team that travels more, that goes further, that does more things, that has better kids. Eventually, if your kid is the best kid on the team, you could just move them up to another league, and now they're the worst kid on the team. So your kid that was playing awesome is now playing the bench. I don't know. I would say in general, for the idea of sports, it's not really worth it. Here's the other problem. You don't know what high school is like. We have a high school coach that takes 27 kids for the girls' soccer team, says there's a JV team, but there's only one JV game, but everyone has to go to these games, and they're really far traveling because we're only, I think we're single A or maybe double A, so they travel like 2 or 3 hours to get to a game, and only 11 girls play, and the other 16 sit on the bench. That's super boring and unmotivating, and some of these kids play high-level club soccer, but most of them play high-level club soccer. And you just don't know what the coach is going to value. I had my kid pulled out of a game because he wasn't popping kids enough when we were losing. And the coach said, I want you to smash kids. And he's like, I don't play like that. So we put him in, put a thug in who never even touched the ball or another kid, but he kept trying. But everyone just got out of his way. So you just don't know. It's a mixed bag. If you're going for the sports aspect, probably the wrong idea. If you're trying to teach a lesson, probably a great idea. I think I like the ideas of the 80s where you could play multiple sports, but I get it. If you don't narrow down, you're probably not going to play a high school on your high school team, but I guess who cares? I think if I could like go back in time and say, let's do a sport that maybe matters for the long term in terms of athletic endeavor, I'd put him in tennis so they could play pickleball, or maybe put him in Rocket League, which is a computer game where a car plays soccer, because kids can do that out of school and they can do it with their friends. But not many of us just break out into a football game or break out into a random soccer game. I do know adults that still play soccer, and all of them are going to get their ACLs repaired. So, you know, for what's that worth? So it depends on the problem you're trying to solve. Is it worth it? I'm going to go with a no. But I did do an episode with my kids, and they all said, yeah, it was worth it. But we also didn't chase the dream, and I let my kids quit when they decided it was time to quit on their own terms. And while I cried on the inside, I didn't, like, belabor them. They just said, hey, I think it's time. I'm like, okay, why? And they had a really good reason why. I mean, Evan, he got accepted into UGA the fall of his senior year. Soccer comes around, it's a spring sport, and he's like, Dad, I already got accepted, so they obviously don't care if I play, and I'd rather hang out with my friends and do something else. I'm like, well, hey, that's valid. Our goal is to get to college. You're not playing soccer in college if you're not enjoying it because it's just not the environment you thought it would be. Well, all right. And so there was a choice to be made there, too. He said, hey, Dad, the team is not what I thought it was. We're a Christian school. It should be a lot of, like help each other up. But it was a lot of put each other down. And he couldn't change it. And they decided, I don't want to change it. I'm like, great, you made a choice. So, man, I hope that answers your questions. I think what I'll do is create an episode on my podcast that's going to be way longer and go into way more depth. So if you need more of that, go over there and check it out. But, Jack, what are your thoughts?
So I, for one, find it insane to invest $80,000 in youth sports. At least it was spread off multiple kids. And I'm not putting Andy down. I just find it insane. And I think about what that money could have done for their future if you want to talk about college scholarships. I'll tell you, there's a lot of college scholarships available to athletes. And they don't necessarily have to be the best in the world to get them if they're flexible with the school that they'll go to. But I'll also tell you this. My nephew, who was at excellent baseball player and a very good long snapper in football, was offered two scholarships to the school that he went to, and he had to pick. One was academic and one was athletic. He chose the academic scholarship, one, because it had more money in it, two, because if he decided he didn't want to be owned by the school as an athlete anymore, he wouldn't have to be. Turned out after 2 years in college, he decided he didn't want to play baseball for that college anymore. Had he accepted the athletic scholarship, he would have been stuck. And I would tell any parent or kid thinking, I'm going to get myself a scholarship in sports, you should talk to people who are in the middle of it. Not who already did it, because survivor bias is a thing. Okay? Talk to some kid, young adult, 21 years old, in their second, third year of college, that's in the middle of a collegiate sports program. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying it might not be what you think it is. And it's good to go into anything with eyes wide open if that's what you're thinking about. The other side of this, I don't know the person asking this was certainly definitely asking about, like, to play pro or even play in college. Like, is there an advantage to competitive sports where, like, you have to really make an effort to play well, to play consistently? It's not just some throw together little league or whatever, or Pop Warner. I think there is. I think there's a lot that can be learned from there. But when it comes to your athletes and knowing whether they're going to really excel or not, there's three types of kids that play sports. There's kids that poke around at it. They like it. They enjoy it. They'll do some pickup basketball or play some sandlot football or whatever if that's their sport. And that was a lot like my son. Okay? That's level one. There is no need to spend any serious amount of money on a kid like that for any level of sports at all. Let them play it wherever they want in the cheapest way possible. And if you can put together something at your neighborhood level that doesn't cost anybody anything, that's enough for that kid. You got kids like my grandson. Dedicated. Will practice for hours hitting, pitching, etc. to the sport. Love him. Probably will never even play at a collegiate level. Why? Because the other things that are necessary to be great in athletics, he has no interest in. So that's your level two kid. He's not going to go. He's only way he's going to be doing, you know, grass drills or really lifting a lot of weights or anything, unless he changes what he wants, right? Like right now, he's just not there, will be when he is forced to by a coach. So he will practice seriously, but he will not practice as an all-around athlete, even though he's old enough to understand it. And I would say, like, your mid-tier, lower-tier, pay-to-play leagues are really good for them because they get the camaraderie, they get all of that stuff, they get the conditioning, and they get to decide if they want to change and up their game. The kid that is going to be able to make it in one of those leagues, as Andy mentioned, will have to have some raw talent in the sport to begin with. Will have to be one of those kids that, at least at the lower level, they are just the best out there, even if they're half-assing it. But they will also be the kid that is going to run wind sprints. They will also be the kid that is going to go to the gym and physically work out and build their strength and build their endurance beyond just I can hit the ball or throw it or catch it, right? That's what it'll take. And I will tell you, like, you know, I played sports in school. I was the middle. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I had plenty of friends that, like, were level one, and I had plenty of friends that were, like, level zero. I'm not interested in competitive sports at all. I don't give a shit. We'll see you when your practice is over. There's room for everybody in this. So my biggest advice is don't let anybody that runs one of these leagues talk to you about this. Because, like Andy said, they're salesmen. They make a lot of money off this shit. It's criminal the amount of money these people make doing this, selling that dream. Let the kid lead. If you think your kid really isn't into it and you're putting time, effort, and money into something, your kid would really probably rather do something else, get them something else to do. They're only kids once. Like, this upper level shit we're talking about, this is for the kid that's driven and knows what they want. If that's not your kid, I don't care how good they are. Let them go do what they want to do. You get to make this kind of decision, and I talk about this, I don't care if it's career, I don't care if it's sports, I don't care what it is. This level of decision, how I'm going to live my life and direct it forward, you get to make that for one person. It's you, it's not your kids. I want my kids to have better than me. Great. That means you guide them into finding it, not you tell them what it is. And I don't care if it's sports or physics or anything. Let people discover what they love and let them discover a way to become great at what they love. And so that way they can discover a way to make a living doing it. All right, moving on. Let's talk about DMSO with Doc Bones.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question for the expert council comes from Nate, who writes, Dr. Bones, what are potential uses and potential dangers of DMSO? Would it be dangerous to combine it with a comfrey salve like Dr. Christopher's to increase penetration? How is DMSO normally used? Frequency and duration of applications. I've got lingering knee pain from a running injury in college 12 years ago that has flared up recently. I've started using comfrey salve until I can get an appointment with an orthopedic. Thanks, Nate. Nate, first let's talk about what is DMSO. That's dimethyl sulfoxide. It's an organosulfur compound that's a byproduct of papermaking. It comes from a substance found in wood, and it all comes often as a colorless liquid commercially. It's an important solvent that dissolves and can mix with a wide range of other organic solvents, as well as water. Dimethyl sulfoxide was first synthesized in 1866 by the Russian scientist Alexander Zaitsev, and it's been used as an industrial solvent since the mid-1800s. From about the mid-20th century, researchers have explored its use as an anti-inflammatory agent. DMSO is a prescription medicine, but is also used as a dietary supplement. It can be taken by mouth, applied to the skin, or given IV. Now, what do we know about DMSO's effectiveness? The FDA has approved DMSO for treating symptoms of painful bladder syndromes. It's also used under medical supervision to treat several other conditions, including shingles and amyloidosis. But we're talking today about its use as an alternative medicine. As a supplement, DMSO is used topically to decrease pain and speed the healing of wounds, burns, and muscle and skeletal injuries. For example, in your issue, Nate, DMSO is also used topically to treat painful conditions such as headache, inflammation, osteoarthritis, and rheumatoid arthritis. It's used topically for eye conditions including cataracts, glaucoma, and problems within the retina. For foot conditions including bunions, calluses, and fungus on toenails, and for skin conditions involving scarring. It's sometimes used topically to treat skin and tissue damage caused by chemotherapy when it leaks from the IV that is used to deliver it. DMSO is also used, either alone or in combination with a drug called idoxuridine, to treat pain associated with shingles. The MSO is FDA approved to be given intravenously to treat bladder infections like interstitial cystitis and chronic inflammatory bladder disease. The MSO is sometimes placed inside bile ducts with other medications to treat bile duct stones. Unfortunately, the hard data for the things the FDA has not officially approved isn't there, at least as of yet. I'm getting a lot of more research is needed, and early results show some promise, as well as early results show no benefit for a lot of the conditions that I just mentioned. That's the problem. A recent analysis of studies on the use of DMSO to relieve osteoarthritis found that it was not significantly more effective than placebo in relieving joint pain. That means it might have been more effective, but just not statistically significantly more. That doesn't mean it can't work for you, though. Other studies consider it promising, and I know a number of people who swear by it despite the lack of hard evidence. There is some data, Nate, that suggested the MSO 50% cream to the skin improves pain in people with an unusual condition called complex regional pain syndrome. Look it up and see if it matches up with your symptoms at all. More importantly, the American Cancer Society says there is no evidence to support the use of DMSO to treat cancer, which is something that it has been promoted for. Using it, they say, can cause serious delays in getting proper treatment and even decreases the effectiveness of chemotherapy. Of some concern, there are no studies that provide guidelines for determining the proper use of DMSO as a supplement. The gel used to treat osteoarthritis typically has a concentration of 25% applied 3 or 4 times a day. There is little or no regulation, however, so DMSO sold without a prescription can range anywhere from 10% to 90% concentration. As for Comfrey, using topical DMSO with Comfrey should increase its effect, which sounds like a good thing. Remember, however, that Comfrey used in stronger ways, like orally, can cause liver and maybe kidney damage. Increasing the effect of a Comfrey poultice with topical DMSO has little research attached, so I can't say that it couldn't happen if used that way. Varying doses have been used in scientific research for different conditions when applied to the skin, but for your condition, as I mentioned before, 25% DMSO, that's been used about 3 times a day, and 45.5% DMSO topical solution has been used 4 times a day. Are there risks to using DMSO? The most frequent side effects from using DMSO on the skin are mild and include stomach upset, skin irritation, and a strong odor of garlic. Using it orally is more dangerous, as is using Comfrey orally. You might get dizziness, drowsiness, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, or constipation. While DMSO decreases the effectiveness of some chemotherapies, it can increase the effect of other medicines like steroids, sedatives, and blood thinners, which can lead to serious health issues. A specific concern of DMSO used topically is that when it gets on the skin, it'll cause anything on the skin to be absorbed, so be sure to wash your hands and skin well before using. Pregnant women and women who are breastfeeding should not use DMSO since little is known about its possible effect on the fetus or infant. Also, talk to your doctor if you have diabetes, asthma, and liver or kidney conditions if you're interested in using DMSO. Always keep in mind that supplements are not regulated by the FDA the same way as drugs are. The manufacturer does not have to prove that a supplement is safe or effective before selling it. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, make sure that your family is medically prepared with quality medical kits and individual supplies from our store at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
All right, while we're on the topic of health, let's talk about your health when it comes to cleaning products, and specifically DIY cleaning products and whether or not to include phosphates and what that means if you do so. Person I send this question to, Nicole Sauce.
Good morning, good morning. Hello, TSP. This is Nicole Sauce from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee, coming to you from the Holler Homestead to answer a question from Ping Pong. And the question is about phosphates. The question is, are phosphates dangerous to use in do-it-yourself household cleaning products, such as a laundry powder and dishwasher detergent? If so, what is a good way to make sure these homemade products rinse well and don't leave residue? I'd like to start making household cleaning products to get away from dangerous chemicals as well as to save some money and build general know-how. I have read that without using proper rinsing agents, homemade soaps tend to not rinse out of clothes, dishes, etc., and that phosphates are great for this. I have read mixed opinions about the dangers of them. I'm wondering if they are something to be worried about, and if so, how to deal with the rinsing problem with homemade cleaning products. It's very interesting that you asked me this question, because I went down the phosphate rabbit trail about a decade ago, and here's why. They have taken phosphates out of detergents that are commercially produced. And the reason they've done this is when a lot of phosphates go into our drain water, it fosters an environment where algae grows. And so that's like the environmental impact you're talking about. As far as do I think they're dangerous, I think in the grand context of, this is an opinion, by the way, in the grand context of what we are exposed to in our lives, the phosphates are not the thing that is a big problem. But I am very concerned in areas where there's high concentrations of them coming out of drains into groundwater of the environmental impact. That being said, you may have noticed your dishwasher doesn't work as well anymore since the change to phosphates. And that's because its primary function in detergent is to soften the water so that, yes, it rinses better. And if you think about it, you can order from a chemical supply company phosphates and add that back into your detergents. But what I have found works better over time, because I did that, by the way, and it works. I just added a little teaspoon of phosphates to every load of dish soap, and it would help it rinse the dishes. But what I found is that it's completely unnecessary if you also think about how it does that. It functions like a salt would. So you know what else helps with rinsing? Salt. Just plain old Jane salt. And then back to homemade detergents and washing powders. If you live like I do in a place where you have pretty hard water and you rely on your own septic system and pipe system for drainage, I have found that any powder that I use tends to bond itself with whatever minerals are in my water and create this white, crusty, stuck on stuff that eventually causes my pipes to be clogged. And so the biggest change I made to counteract that beyond the phosphates was never use powdered anything again. Liquid detergents with no powders in them do a much better job of A, rinsing, and B, not getting stuck in your pipes. When I feel like I need a little extra oomph in my dishwasher, I add a little bit of vinegar or I add some salt just to help with that. And that's all I've ever needed to do. I've been using household, like homemade cleaners in both areas for a long time. I have gone back to some commercial liquid cleaners just to save time, but I'd be happy to use, if somebody else was producing and selling, more natural cleaners. Because really your first question is it dangerous? Well, you're adding a chemical that you have to order from a chemical supplier to your soaps or detergents when you add phosphates, wherein if you want to keep it to just basic ingredients that you can easily source from your local community, do that. I think with making soap, though, you're probably going to be adding lye either way unless you go down the whole rabbit trail of making, like, the glycerin-based soaps like Dr. Bronner's. Because Dr. Bronner's is, you know, a pretty... You can brush your teeth with it, you can wash with it, you can do your laundry with it. I've recently gotten a Kangen water machine, which uses the electrolysis method to change the pH of water, and I have found through experimentation with the dirtiest, smelliest clothes I could find, which is the ones that Tactical wears outside all day in the sun on the homestead, I can actually just add 2 quarts of 11.5 pH water, which is an alkaline water, to my laundry, and it gets the load clean, and it eliminates any of the body odors. It does not end up smelling like fresh washed laundry if you do not add a scent back in, like an essential oil or something. Anyway, I hope this gets you started. I would say this, if you're already asking, do I want to add this chemical because I'm trying to get away from chemicals, probably the answer is no. I mean, it sounds like you don't want to add chemicals, and that's a chemical. So do some experiments with making some liquid products and see how they work for you. And you'll learn over time what works and what doesn't work. In general, though, for homemade soaps and detergents, I prefer to stay away from powders just because they do clog up without a water softener to help aid them along. Hope this helps you on your journey to just get started and stop overanalyzing. If you want to connect with me, head over to NicoleSauce.com. I've got a webinar next week with Joel Salatin talking about his time management program for his farm, and we're going to sort of apply it to the homestead scale activities. The cost for that is $45. That's over at NicoleSauce.com. Make it a great week.
Next up, let's get a permaculture subject on the board, dealing with a drain system that has been clogged by cattails, and we'll go to Jeff Lawton for that answer.
Hi, Jeff Lawton, coming to you from Australia, and we've got a question about cattails clogging up a drain in a real estate situation, and they want to know what they can do to take their cattails or stop the cattails taking over this drain and causing choking. And it's a sort of classic question, and you've set up a condition that's ideal for cattails. So that's water that's 2 foot deep or less, and they are one of the fastest or one of the most efficient biomass creators on the planet. Their rhizomes are, I think they create more animal forage than any other plant. I mean, you've got to get them out for animals to eat it, but the amount of biomass they produce with their roots is just about number one, I think. So there's a couple of ways you can approach this. One is make the water more than 2 foot deep. They'll still probably come on the edge, but won't clog the main channel. So it becomes a deeper aquatic water system. You've got an ideal aquatic water system for cattails. So deepen it. That's one thing. The other thing to do is increase the fall. So it's moving faster. So they don't grow in really fast water. And that both of those might not be possible. The third one would be make a product out of them. Make it an economic gain. And that might not be what you want to do. That might not be your game. But they would be creating a large amount of not just biomass, but nutrient-dense silt, mineral-rich silt. So when you take them out, don't waste them. Turn them into a product which you can sell on or create an asset for the local community. Otherwise, you're stuck with cattails. You've created a situation that suits them, and they are going to be very, very difficult to get out. They will keep coming back. So deepen them, steepen them, or reap them into something that's valuable. That's about it, I'd say. Good luck.
As I alluded to in the intro, cattails are definitely something that can quickly go from a problem being the solution to a solution becoming the problem due to their aggressive growth. And this is something that if you're designing some sort of aquatic system and you're going to include cattails as a filter in it, you should think about limiting the impact of the cattails from the beginning of the design. I know that doesn't help the person here, but I always try to expand these subjects so that they are more universal to more people. So I can see a lot of people at some point putting in ponds and other aquatic elements in their systems and thinking, hey, cattails are great for purifying water. And they are. So we either need to design our drain so that we, like Jeff said, we limit how much is in shallow enough water for them to actually be there, so we limit their impact, or we need to think about some other way to mitigate them or make them easier to harvest or something. Because if you've ever tried to dig up even a small amount of cattail, it is amazing how absolutely matted their roots get. I put one little miniature cattail into like a 4-inch net pot at the beginning of a season and set it into one of my garden ponds. And by the end of that season, it was growing outside. It was expanding. It was sending rhizomes out into the water. And what started out as basically pond muck to grow the cattail in, which was perfect for it, there was nothing in it. There was no dirt left. It almost looked like it ate the dirt. So they are pretty tough to control if you're not thinking about it right from square one. So if you're going to use them as a design element, make sure you're thinking about it right from the beginning. Next up, let's hear from Ben Falk on designing home workshops and wood shops.
Hey, Jack and all, Ben Falk with Whole Systems Design. Just a little segment here on home shop, farm shop, workshop principles, design features, tips and tricks, because we just released our online course on the topic. And after the last 25 plus years of working in shops and 20 years of making, designing and building and working in two different shops at two different scales on our sites, kind of tried to distill some really important aspects of what I've learned down into this workshop, and wanted to just share a small part of those with you right now. So one of the most important things that people tend to forget is siting their shop strategically. A workshop is super of a high value space. You're going to be there, you know, as often as maybe you end up in your kitchen. So it has to be in zone one, in permaculture speak, really close to your home, if not attached. And it wants to have really good positive outdoor space, which for us in a cold climate is like a protected warm microclimate with sun access, solar access, and wind protection. And in the warmer the climate gets, the shadier you want to be able to, more shade you want to be able to provide to those spaces, but you still usually want some solar access throughout the air. Often wind protection is still important, although you may want to encourage breezes in really warm climates and buggy climates. You want flat, hard ground, of course, outside. The more access, the better. You can't really have too much vehicular access to a shop space for project needs, material deliveries, things like that. You want co-location with sheds for material storage, because you can only put so much materials in your shop. As many of us know, it's easy to just overwhelm your workspace with lumber, scrap metal that you're going to work with, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the kind of holy grails I've found is like a workshop, you know, workspace that has big open doors opening to the south, and then on all sides you're flanked by sheds for wind protection. And so that's a courtyard. Courtyards are gold. And those sheds are where all your materials are. One, it could be a chicken shed, one or two for lumber, you know, one for all sorts of miscellaneous materials. You need those, that store close by. It's like the pantry is to the kitchen. Some other principles I found are really, really helpful is task lighting, making sure you don't have to light the heck out of the whole place, but really good task lighting, like right over workbenches. Speaking of workbenches, a metal workbench with a metal top, like a 3/8 inch nice plate of steel 4x4, a good welding table on wheels, ideally the shop's on a slab, really hard to beat. I roll that thing all around my shop. I also made like a welding cart that's all metal. I can roll that around. I can like pull my truck up to the shop, roll the cart right to that spot, weld on the truck, roll the workbench right up. Very efficient. Buy good casters. Don't cheap out on those. I've done that before, and it's not worth it. It's more expensive, of course, when you change them out to the good stuff. That workbench is going to be at least 1,000 pounds. I put some scrap metal underneath it, so the heavier the better. A big leg vise on those is really awesome, especially if you get into blacksmithing. You can really pound on it. I've replaced my older vise with a leg vise pretty recently. And then a vertical, like, tool surface. Vertical tool surfaces and storage surfaces in general are gold. If you can put it up on a wall, do that versus shove it in a drawer. I found that unless you're Rain Man and you can remember exactly where it was in which drawer, you want to be able to see it all. So vertical, tall vertical surfaces are gold in a shop. But some things you do have to shove in, you know, in drawers, of course, really small items, card catalogs. I've gone out of my way on Craigslist when I can find old metal card catalogs, which are increasingly hard to find, but they're awesome for, you know, bolts, washers, nuts, all the small items, hasps, magnets, you know, you name it, just all the little items where there's like hundreds of categories of things you might have two or five of. So really small containers are great for organization. But anything that can be up wants to be up and not stuffed in a drawer. A lot of people, mechanics, you know, are used to putting wrenches, like box end wrenches, six-sided wrenches, combo wrenches in drawers. I hang them up right on the wall. They just get a mess and they become a mess in drawers. I'm sure people make it work, but for me, it's everything stays super organized when up vertically. Getting everything off the floor, up on the walls, or even hung off the ceilings. It's really, really helpful. Keeping everything super organized. Of course, everything having a home, never returning it to a different place than you got it, as long as it was in the right place to begin with. And, of course, getting the highest quality tools you can afford, keeping it organized. The bigger access doors you have, the better within reason. If you have a need for a serious insulation, then that might be a reason to have smaller doors. But I have 12 and 16-foot doors on my newer shop last 11 years, and sometimes I still wish that the 16-foot wide door was a little bit wider. When you run out of something, buy two. If you're going to, you know you're going to use it, running out of, Lexel caulk, okay, just get two next time. If stuff keeps, trips to the hardware store are killers, especially in a rural area. Having a stock is so valuable, and it saves you money. Never mind the vulnerability of that material, you know, not being available in bumpy times. If you have to break your flow to go to the hardware store to get more 2.5-inch screws, which we're always going through, of course, or whatever it is, quarter-inch bolts, you lose way more time than the time to just drive to the store and back, because you lose your flow, and that's not really enjoyable at all. I mean, now for me, when I get a project done with no trips to the hardware store, which is increasingly the case, it's just way more fun and obviously way more efficient. Bunch of tips. Those are some principles. Bunch of tips and tricks is I'll mention of like having magnet bit holders, putting everything on, I mean, as much as you can using magnets, rare earth magnets. I don't know why everyone doesn't epoxy a rare earth magnet to the back of their impact driver and drill, cordless tool. Why look for bits? I mean, you could carry a bit case around with you, but that's kind of a pain. I just put them right on magnets. I always have, you know, a square drive, a Phillips, and then like T15, T20, T25. And if I'm doing shed work, I need T30s for like larger driving lags. They're always on right on the back of my impact. I don't have to go look for them. 5-inch grinder discs for a 4 or 4.5-inch angle grinder. They're cheaper and they work better. Just a little hack. There's a lot more in our course. And yeah, hope you can join us over there. It's on my website, wholesystemsdesign.com. And we have a lot of other programs there as well. Thanks a lot.
All right, good stuff from Ben. I do have a link to the course that he offers on this in the show notes of today's episode, right next to the bullet point where it mentions Ben's segment. All right, now it's time for my segment today. I got an email from a gentleman in the audience, and he said, Jack, I want to understand how to get these dadgone fish that I'm sourcing locally to eat pellets. So this is a very common thing. One goes to a park pond or creek or something like that, a lake, and catches some bullhead cats or, let's say, some channel cats, as long as they're at least a foot long and legal, depending on where you are. They have different size limits. Or something really common like various panfish like bluegills or pumpkin seeds or green sunfish. They bring them home and they put them into some form of a tank. And then the next day they throw a handful of pellets in there and nothing happens. And the next day you throw a handful of pellets in there and nothing happens. All right, so the reality here is this is exactly the way that an 80s mom or a 70s mom got kids to eat. If you don't feed them for long enough, they will get hungry and they will eat. Fish are also, in a way, like birds. They're nowhere near as intelligent. I don't believe that they're even close to the sentient as a bird is. I think a bird is one of our more intelligent critters. It knows what it is. It knows who it is. It knows that it's an individual. I don't think fish have that. They don't have a prefrontal cortex. So I don't mean that they are analogous to birds the way that birds are analogous to some reptiles, for instance. Like lizards and birds are quite related, actually. They're not related. But they do practice mimicry. That's one place they overlap. So all I need to do is get one or two fish eating the pellets, and then there'll be three, and then there'll be four, and soon they will all be eating the pellets. And so all I need to do is keep everybody hungry enough for long enough, and they will eat the pellets. So the big worry, though, is there is nothing that will screw up the balance of an aquatic system more than rotting food that's not consumed. It's way, way, way worse than excessive fish poop and pee. Okay? Rotting food worse than the fish waste, and can easily overload a system even that is well designed. So what I suggest is when you first add fish to a tank, and there's no fish in there that are already pellet feeding, so there's no mimicry to attract the new fish's attention, understand what's happened. This fish has lived its life. It was born as an egg. It had to be a hell of an evasive little critter to not get gobbled up by a bigger fish when it was growing up. It managed to get big enough that you caught it. It was minding its own business. A sharp pain hit it in the mouth. It got yanked out of its water. It got stuck in a bucket or something. The water churned all around, and then it got tossed into this tank. Now it's sitting in this place that's much smaller than it's used to. It's surrounded by other fish. Doesn't know what's going on. It is freaking freaked out, to use a human term. Okay, so it's probably not going to eat anything for a while. Now, I've seen some like instantly start eating. Like they're just deep-to-deep fish, and they're great for that, right? But usually when you start a new tank up and you start bringing in fish, they don't want to eat. You also probably have minnows and other small fish in there, and they may begin to eat some of those, right? So they don't get that hungry. And so the most important thing is to pretty much leave them alone for at least a week. Don't even try to feed them for at least a week. After about a week, go out and you will find fish in general, but especially in captivity like this, they will tend to want to eat toward the end of the day. So when the sun is actually beginning to really sink in the sky, it's still light out, it's not dark, you can see without a flashlight, but if you waited another hour, you would need a flashlight. That's the point, 1 hour before total sundown. Go out and throw way less feed than they need in the tank. Watch and give them some time and see if they eat. If they do not eat, go 3 or 4 days before you do it again. And do it again. And when they do begin to eat, don't get excited and throw a bunch of food in. It will probably only be a small number of them who finally crack and start to eat. Watch, make sure they eat all the food. Wait 2 days, 3 days, something like that. Do it again. When they begin to wipe the food out, increase the food until they are consuming all the food in a reasonable amount of time. 5-10 minutes, all the food is gone. You've got your fish successfully trained. Now, that is the... I gave him the short answer. That is the middle answer. Let me add a few things that add it all together. It becomes the long answer. And it also has a great deal to do with how are these fish being housed. If you are housing 100 bluegills or 100 bullheads in a 330-gallon IBC with no structure in it, like an aquaponics system, this really will take some time because, one, they're competitive and they fight with each other and they have no place to go, so they're constantly worried about somebody shiving them in the back. So think of prison. When you put people in prison, they're pretty chill when they're in their cell with their door closed, even though they don't want to be there, because if they don't have a cellmate, there's no one else in there with them, and they're pretty damn safe. When they're out in the yard, right, and somebody comes up to them and goes, hey, man, what are you in for? Really? Are you sure? Because we're going to find out. Like, you start to worry, right? You start to get paranoid. That's how that fish feels. You threw it in prison, and it's stuck in the yard. It has no place to go to retreat. So I'm not saying not to do that because those are good reservoirs for fish in an aquaponics system. I'm just saying you got to think about your species, and it's important anyway, but it becomes imperative if that's what you're going to do. Don't go throwing 12-inch bullheads in with 6-inch bullheads in that system, because what you're going to end up with is a small number of really big bullheads. They will eat each other. Don't go throwing great big hand-sized bluegills into that system with a whole bunch of little fingerling bluegills, because the big ones are going to beat the shit out of the little ones. They won't eat them. Well, they will when they die, and then they'll pick their bones. And you need to really be careful with combining species in that type of tank. If we're talking something more like the backyard ponds that I build, you know, 8x8, 12x12, lots of area, lots of structure. I build structure out of things like cinder blocks and all. You can get away with more of it. I would still say it makes a good deal of sense to set an objective size for fish introduced into a system and say, let's say we're going to do bullheads. They're a great fish. Do only bullheads. And say, I'm going to go with small bullheads, 4 to 6 inches. If it's under 4 inches, I'm throwing it back. If it's over 6 inches, I'm throwing it back. If it's much over 6 inches, maybe I'm going to go ahead and eat it. Or if you have multiple tanks to kind of segregate based on that and bring your young fish into one, and then as it grows out and you start harvesting from it, bring young fish into the other one that you've already mostly harvested, something like that. So give them time, give them cover, do not harass them, but here's the big last thing. Don't be like a nervous Nelly parent that thinks your kid's going to die because they skipped dinner. Okay? This is one of the big problems. My kid won't eat anything good for him. How hungry are they? Because, yes, they will. If they go to bed hungry one night, they'll wake up really hungry, and eventually they'll eat what you put in front of them. Now, unlike your kids, like if your kids go a week without eating, you might have, like, the Department of Making You Sad actually be right and come to you and say, hey, you're abusing your kids. Your kids haven't eaten in a week. While they're in growth stage, this is bad. Let me tell you about fish. That is not how fish work. You can go weeks without feeding fish. They will be fine. Their metabolism will slow down. They'll eat what they can find. They'll eat things they wouldn't otherwise eat. They may even eat each other. But even if they don't eat much, they will not die. And the colder the water becomes, okay, the more this is true. And after a certain point, the warmer the water becomes, the more this is true. When the water gets really warm, not to where it threatens their existence, but they're just not happy about it, they kind of get sluggish and they just kind of sit there and wait for things to chill out. So, if it takes 3 weeks before those fish eat a pellet, if it takes 4 weeks, it's okay. I would tell you, you could throw them in there and do nothing for 2 to 3 weeks. No one's going to starve to death. It's a fish. It's not a dog. It's not a monkey. It's not a person. It's more like a reptile. If you have a snake and it doesn't eat for a month, it's going to be hungry. And when you throw a rat in there, that rat is duck shit. But that snake is in no danger at that point. And he could then go 2 months without eating. Okay? And I'm not saying that if you're a reptile keeper and you're thinking that's bad husbandry, you're correct. There is a reasonable feeding schedule, but then you also know what I'm saying. The animal is in no jeopardy by going that length of time. A fish going a month without food, it sounds insane. It's not that big of a deal. Once my water temperature goes below about 55 degrees, I barely, if ever, feed anything until we come into spring. Okay? And what I'll do at about that temperature, I'll throw a little bit out there, and if they eat, sure, I'll feed them. As soon as I see that feeding taper off, that's it. I'll see you in spring. And my fish, as you guys know who have been here, they do fantastic. I have some catfish swimming around there that are like, you know, if I held them up by the gills at my knee, their tails would be on the ground, right? I've got some big 7, 8, 9, 10, I bet a couple out there, they're probably 11, 12 pounds. And they can go, there's times where I go 4 or 5 days without feeding them because I get busy or whatever and I don't have automatic feeding and I'd rather underfeed than overfeed. Don't stress this. It's not a dog. It's not a kitty cat. It's a fish. They are designed through evolution to eat whatever they need, whenever they need it, and to go through shortages because in nature, that happens. It's why when you find certain schooling fish, like white bass or stripers, and they're working bait fish, you almost can't not catch them because when they're in that mode and that surplus is available, they gorge because they are, again, they are designed to be able to take as much in as possible and then to go like a camel does with water for a long period of time if necessary before they can eat again. So you have to wait. You have to be patient and understand that just like that kid that says he's not going to eat dinner, if that dinner keeps coming back and there's no Twinkies and Ho-Hos and candies, sooner or later that kid is going to eat the food that's available to them. And it's actually much easier with a fish because you don't have to look at their faces. They're in the water. All right. One more thing, real quick. If they are in some kind of smaller containment system, blocking out light from the sides, things like that, so that they don't feel exposed as much as you can would be useful. And in IBCs, I recommend putting some sort of structure in there for them so they have places they can get away from each other. And I know what people say, well, what about when you have to net them out? Remove the structure. You can put center blocks down on the ground and tie cordage of some sort to them so you can pull them up and out would be one example of how you could do that. All right. With that, Let's go ahead and wrap things up. We have knocked out another week of new content. Of course, tomorrow we will have a Friday flashback. I want to talk to you today about the ice machine that I talked to you about yesterday with T-Spaz. Remember, if you shop on T-Spaz, no matter what you buy, you help us out. Something weird as hell happened yesterday. I have not heard back from my rep. I do not know what it was. V-Lor has this awesome 37-pound a day countertop ice maker. Super simple to use. Fill it up, push a button, turn it on, and it works. There's a little more to it, but I have a write-up and a video that shows it all. But, I mean, that's really, I mean, like, if you can't make it work, you probably shouldn't have one. And these things usually sell for like $289. Yesterday morning, somebody commented on the blog and said, "Is this the right link? This thing is $350." I'm like, "You're crazy." I clicked the link. I'm like, "No, you're not." And I checked, and they had jacked up not just that one. Vivor had, I don't know if something went glitchy, but every ice maker on their site was jacked up to full price or more, including ones that had been on sale. And I'm like, "I don't understand." So I checked, and Amazon had the same machine for $170, so I redirected the traffic there yesterday. That meant you couldn't get the 5 points off, the additional 5% off with my discount code. Well, this morning, on a lark, I checked. It's knocked back down to $169 where it's supposed to be. So if you want to get that ice maker, and you haven't gotten one yet, and about 50 of y'all have between Amazon and Vivor Direct, because it's just such an awesome deal, you can. For now, how long that'll last, I don't know. I think there might have been some sort of inventory alert glitch in their system, because it said something about low inventory when that price went up, and that's gone today, and the price is back where it belongs. Anyway, this thing is awesome. It makes pelletized ice, the kind that you get with like a big, you know, like a Big Gulp or something, the stuff you could chew on. It's just fantastic, and once it gets going, it takes a while to get going. Once it gets going, it is fast. Because while it's making them, it's just like every couple seconds it's dropping a few pellets until it fills up. And it resets beautifully as it melts down. It'll kick in and start running again. Again, check it out. Check out the video I did on it. I'm very excited to be working with Vivor. They've been a great company to work with. And a lot of you have found a lot of really great products with them. Remember, you can get 5% off anything at Vivor always if you go to tspaz.com, and if you use my link and my code, you make sure that I get credit for the order. And you can also find all the stuff that you want to buy on Amazon at tspaz.com, and all the products I've reviewed over the years. It's over 500 products I have personally put my hands on and reviewed for you across all the sectors that we talk about: cooking, backyard gardening, all of it. It's all there, tspaz.com, the way to help us out without spending any money you weren't going to spend anyway, just shopping through the T-Spaz portal and getting the advantage of having the reviews that I've done. Remember, everything I look at as a price-to-value ratio. That's what I'm always looking at. Not what's the very best, because that would be the Lamborghini or Ferrari that we can't afford, and not what's the cheapest, because that's the Geo Metro or some shit, the Yugo? We don't want that crap either, right? We don't want a car with a lawnmower engine in it. We want something we know is high quality at a good value. That's what I look for, because that's how we maximize our lifestyle design. With that, I'll catch you guys on Monday with a new show and that Friday flashback tomorrow. Bail you out, just run you around. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay.